You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Bill, Jim, thank you very much for making the time for this conversation today as we hit this sort of turning point moment in the history of the BCRC. Great to have you both here to tell us a little bit about what the Commission's been doing and a look ahead into the future, perhaps, as well. Jim Sullivan, as many of you know, has been the executive director of the BCRC for the past 12 years. He's also been with the organization for the total of 33 years altogether. So, Jim, I thought we could start with you and have you tell us a little bit about how you got started at the BCRC. What was your first job there?
Ah, I don't know. Can I remember that far back, Andrew? So, actually, I came to the BCRC from the town of Manchester, where I had worked in the planning and zoning office for about 3 years, from the mid-80s till 1989. And was hired by the BCRC when there was a lot of push to kind of expand planning programs throughout the state and improve the support that the regional commissions were giving to municipalities. So some of my first jobs were really helping to implement what was then known as Act 200, which was Governor Kunin's big initiative around planning to support local plans and to develop consistency between local, regional, and statewide planning efforts. So that was, it was a great way to get started because I immediately went around and met with all 17 of our municipalities to get us all on the same page. And, we were also doing some other interesting things at the time that were really enjoyable. That was just about the time that the Regional Commission was working with the towns in the region and the National Forest to expand the proclamation boundary, the Green Mountain National Forest. So we were doing a lot of environmental studies and economic impact studies around that proposal.
Wow. So is the main purpose of a Regional Commission then land use planning or what's included in the portfolio?
That's an important point. We started out, all the regional commissions in Vermont really started out 50 plus years ago. The BCRC was formed in the late 60s. And the intent at that time really was to address a real boom in development in Vermont that the state was and the communities in Vermont really were ill-prepared to deal with. So the intent was to, with the regional commissions, was really to develop first regional plans to help the state with some statewide planning and to work specifically providing technical support to all the municipalities in developing municipal plans and land use regulations, zoning bylaws, subdivision, things like that. Over time, as needs have developed and opportunities presented themselves, regional commissions have gotten involved in a lot more things, like transportation planning, community and economic development, emergency management, solid waste, transportation, energy planning. So we've definitely grown and diversified over time, but where we started really was in comprehensive planning support for towns and land use planning, and that's still a lot of what we do.
Mm. And Bill, you've also been with the commission for quite a while now. I know you also started as a planner for the town of Bennington.
Well, I was back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was the community and economic development director at the town of Bennington, and then did some private real estate development work and other consulting work in that community and economic development space. So really, late 90s is when my career in community and economic development planning and implementation and real estate development work started in the region. In terms of when I joined BCRC, in kind of an interesting discussion to be had here about the evolution of BCRC, and I think really, in particular, kind of the entrepreneurial approach that Jim has taken to the commission and looking for opportunities to serve the municipalities in the region. But I was doing community and economic development work up in Wilmington and assisting in the flood recovery process after Tropical Storm Irene. And, obviously had known Jim for years and got a call from Jim one day asking what might be available for lunch at some point in the near future. And so we met for lunch and I think late 2011 or early 2012. And, you know, Jim said, our communities are really approaching us, expressing an interest in additional support in community and economic development planning. And do you think you might have any interest in come in and on as a consultant maybe to start and seeing if we can build a program? And I said, wow, it sounds fun. I'd love to be back in Bennington doing, you know, the type of work that I've been doing. And Jim said, great, we have no money to do this. And if we can't figure it out, then it's going to be a really short gig for you. So here we are, you know,
the pressure's on.
Yeah, 10 plus years later, you know, with a, I think, a pretty highly functioning community and economic development program. We've got, you know, a few people working in that program, you know, myself, Jonathan Cooper, some other staff, depending on projects, comes in to support the work as well, and, you know, have evolved into one of the only two combined regional planning and regional development corporations in the state. So, you know, I really do give a lot of credit to Jim for the foresight there and trying to create a nimble enough organization to respond to the needs of the municipalities, and I'm certainly hoping that that's an approach that I can take as we move forward.
So there are 11 regional commissions around the state. Have all of them seen the same kind of expansion of their the type of work they take on that you folks have seen, or is just that, or is each one of them kind of different in their own way?
Well, there's some diversity to be sure. A lot of the programs that are rolled out at the state level are implemented through all 11 regional planning commissions through statewide contracts or through a contract that the state gives to one region and then they subcontract with all the other regions to do similar work. But there is significant diversity in some of the areas of specialization amongst regional commissions. Like Bill said, you know, the economic development sphere is one where we've been heavily involved in, and you know, we also handle all of the support work for the Bennington County Solid Waste Alliance, and I think only one other regional commission in Southern Windsor County, Mount Anthony Regional Commission, does that work. So that, and then, you know, they all have, you know, depending on, you know, staff and commissioner interest, their areas of particular specialization and interest. Mine over the last 15 years has been, you know, energy work. So I think the BCRC has been pretty, you know, looked to for leadership and on a lot of energy and climate issues. So, but there's, I'm going to say the majority of commissions' work is similar, but there is a little bit of difference from commission
sure.
to commission.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I would agree with that and really kind of juxtapose that against kind of the other side of the state-supported ledger being the regional development corporations. There are 12 of those around the state, and again, two of them are the combined RPC, RDC. They're very different organization and size. They range from less than one FTE up in Lake Champlain Islands to, you know, 14 people down in Brattleboro Development Credit Corp. And it really depends on, there's a state contract that kind of sets out standards, but beyond that, there's a much more latitude. So some of them have lending programs, many of them own real estate, some of them don't. So much more diversity on that side. The planning commissions are all, you know, roughly 8 to 12 people, similarly sized, and a similar work plan from the state, which is, I think, much more dictated than on the development side.
I was thinking, let's drill down into a little bit of some of that work that you do, and there seems, from the outside anyway, two main areas that I think are certainly of great interest currently and have been really for a while, too. It's something new. Environmental energy projects, like you were mentioning there, Jim, and also housing. When last night, Bill, you and I were up at a housing forum in Manchester, where we had the housing commissioner, Josh Hanford, and several other folks down to talk about housing projects around not only Bennington County, but the state as a whole. So I'd love to get into that, but I thought maybe we could start with the energy environmental aspect of that. There seems to have been, I mean, from my perspective, and I'm really interested to hear what both of you think about this, seems to be a very, it seems to be awfully hard to get energy, renewable energy projects going wherever they may be proposed. It always seems like there's some neighboring landowner or abutter who thinks, solar energy is great, but I don't want to have to look at it out my front porch. The NIMBY factor, I guess, as it's often called, not in my backyard. Is that really, how do you guys deal with that? What is the best strategy for kind of coping with, you know, that kind of pushback and just finding appropriate locations for these sorts of projects?
Well, that's, kind of goes back to where we started the Regional Energy Planning Initiative a number of years ago to try to get a handle on that and some related issues. And I think that what we did was first to try to properly frame what's going on in that realm and say, okay, what is the current state of, energy? Like, how much energy do we use? How much are we going to have to use in the future? Where is it, where is it going to come from? How much is going to be imported? How much needs to be produced locally? How is it going to be used for heating, for transportation, whatever? What strategies can we do to use as little energy as possible? And then we get around to those really sticky questions of, okay, given that there really needs to be some local generation of energy, where does it go? Because these new distributed energy projects are so much different than all the energy generation projects of the past, where you had one giant coal plant or a nuclear plant serving a huge area and, transmission lines coming out from that. Instead, all of a sudden, energy generation projects can happen anywhere, anywhere the sun shines or the wind blows. So it has taken an effort to try to get a handle on that by working with towns and the state to figure out where the important resources are from a statewide perspective and from a local perspective. Where are places where you really want to avoid impacts and where are places where the community is going to be more accepting of these types of projects? I think we've done a lot of work with our mapping and geographical analysis and community outreach and implementing some of these things through local enhanced energy plans. But it's an ongoing process, and so we're still working to move that forward. But I think the biggest thing is just kind of raising everybody's awareness and understanding of the issue of energy and just how important energy is going forward to everything in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I would, Jim obviously is one of the foremost energy experts in the state, so he's got a really very deep background in this. But it seems to me that we're going to be up against a push point here in the not too distant future. Obviously, recent reporting about Vermont is already trailing behind its tracking for its 2030 climate action goals. So we'll see what the legislature does in terms of ramping up pressure or adjusting kind of those goals, but a lot of attention, a lot of focus, certainly on energy, and I expect it will certainly continue to remain at the forefront of the work that we do.
And people, people put an awful lot of emphasis, rightly so, on climate change and global warming. But there's a really significant economic issues and just long-term sustainability and community viability issues around energy. I just checked the oil prices yesterday for home heating oil, and they're pushing up toward $6 a gallon now in a lot of places. And, over time, that's not going to get better. So no matter what you might think about global warming or climate change, we have to find ways to do things that are more affordable for people and are more sustainable over the long term. And so a lot of that falls in the electrification of both transportation and heating systems, which goes back to the renewable energy stuff you were talking about, Andrew.
So that oil price increase, I'm assuming, is some kind of outgrowth of the war in Ukraine and global economic factors?
Fossil fuel prices have always been subject to a lot of volatility for a lot of different reasons, market forces and international affairs, as you mentioned. And that's one of the reasons to try to get away from them. It is very hard to base your economy on something that's subject to that much volatility. And, long term is not something that's going to, be getting any better. So
are you anticipating the legislature taking more action on that economic environment piece there in 2023 when they get back to work in Montpelier? Or I mean, they tried and failed to pass the clean heat standard, which is, I guess, the big initiative right. in this past session. Do they need to kind of come back and do something more on that front, or are we already sort of falling so far behind reaching these goals for 2030 that that's so?
I mean, personally, I think that they would do well to reframe this as some initiatives they can take to support economic opportunity, job growth, and diversification in the state, because there's, and frankly, just retention of money in the state of Vermont, because we export so much money, especially as prices are going up. 90% of that money leaves the state when you're talking about oil and gas and things. So you know, talk about this, that you're really concerned about affordability in Vermont and economic strength and vitality. You know, talk about keeping the money we've got here rather than exporting it. So if they do something, I hope that they frame it that way, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of political baggage around, you know, energy and climate change and that. So, I mean, I think Jim suggested reframing about the impacts at the, you know, household level on finances is a really important one.
So let's turn to the housing front as well. And Bill, you know, we were both at that forum last night. I guess, what were your takeaways from that meeting last night, and how intractable is it going to be to kind of make headway on the whole housing shortage problem, which is a statewide, well, a nationwide problem, really?
Yeah.
Certainly is an acute one here in Bennington County.
It certainly is. And, you know, on the community economic development side, a large part of our work is going out and meeting with businesses and understanding kind of what their challenges are. And pre-pandemic, and, you know, as we kind of have transitioned through, first and foremost, those discussions were about workforce and the availability. And that's only been exacerbated during the course of the pandemic. But now it's not just workforce, it's finding people to work here and where are they going to live. So we had a recent discussion with a company in Bennington yesterday, hired a, you know, senior level engineer who relocated from Texas, is living in Troy because that's the closest available housing that they could find to Bennington. So, you know, upper, you know, high level professional position, you know, can't find suitable housing. So, and it goes at every level. You know, we've heard a lot from the state. Huge credit to the administration and the legislature for really making a historic level of investment, you know, close to $350 million using, you know, ARPA and CARES Act dollars over the past couple of years into housing, and really trying to form programs that address housing at multiple levels, you know, at the affordable, at the workforce, even at market and homeownership type programs. I think, interestingly, we heard last night about at least in the northern part of the county, an interest in what are the opportunities to expand the home ownership model. We heard honest reactions that traditionally not a lot of money has been focused in that home ownership realm. And, you know, I think to a degree that is because there's difficulty in finding a model that doesn't simply take state money and put it in private people's pocket, which is, you know, of concern to the legislature and, you know, perhaps rightly so. So that balance is going to be struck in there somewhere. But there's challenges on the construction side, as we heard last night. You know, prices changing 12 or 15% over the course of 60 days or less, you know, going up. So until that kind of supply chain issues and labor issues are settled, I'm not sure how much headway we're actually going to be able to make.
So is there any sense that in a couple of years, let's say, that person who arrived from Texas and has a job in Bennington County can actually find a house somewhere in Bennington County?
Well, I mean, we certainly hope so. We just completed, as part of a reuse study for the Energizer facility in Bennington, you know, a kind of townwide housing assessment just looking at Bennington. And it shows the need for new or renovated, reconfigured housing units of 1,006 units in a community whose population is relatively flat. So part of the issue is this kind of mismatch between what is market interest now in the housing available and what is available on the market. There's less interest probably in those kind of large, kind of outed, you know, outside of downtown estate type of homes that we have, you know, particularly in the northern part of the county, but throughout the county, for a lot of what kind of the younger buyers are now interested in. More interest in kind of being closer to the, or in the urban core. We certainly saw that with the Putnam project. You know, 31 units there, completed construction November 30th, 2020, December 1st, next day. Those 31 units were full, and we've had a waiting list for all of those units every day since. So, you know, we're seeing that change in the market, too. So at some point, what's available for housing stock needs to come into alignment with the demand in the market.
Yeah, I think we've seen, you know, construction cost has been a huge issue. You know, in my little subdivision that I live in North Bennington, there's three or four empty lots, and I think they've all sold and been resold probably three times since COVID started, because people would buy them and say, this is a really nice little neighborhood to live in, and build a house here, and they get the estimates of what the cost would be, and they put the lot back on the market. So, you know, that's a real challenge, and it's something that we have to get a hold of. And I think that's what we've seen, you know, as far as hitting a reasonable price point for, you know, workforce housing for people who want to move to the area, you know, a lot of interest in some of those housing programs through some of the state programs. I think it's really important. And I did want to say, I think it's going to be something that we absolutely have to get a handle on, because I do think more people are going to be moving to Vermont and wanting to move to Vermont. And that's a good thing for us. We need people, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a challenge. I mean, Vermont's in a real, you know, sweet spot, right? Goldilocks zone, right? They say, you know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's not too wet, it's not too dry, you know? I mean, it's a beautiful place to live. And I think the demand for housing is going to go up, and we have to figure out a way to accommodate the people who want to move here. Yeah.
So that brings to mind the thought, the renovation of the old Bennington High School building in Bennington, yeah, I'm sure, is a big piece of this. Is that going to be, how many housing units might be created out of that old building?
I think the latest number I saw was close to 50.
50
units there. Wow. And that, you know, primarily in the historic part of the building, the current plan would have the town taking over the gym and cafeteria spaces of that building and using those for kind of community-facing uses. But, yeah, there's 50 units there. Putnam Phase 2 is being planned, which would be 60 new units. There's another 60-unit project, which has been permitted in downtown Bennington. So there's a 14-unit development in Bennington currently underway. We heard a lot last night about some development that Bill Drunzik is doing in Manchester and others. So there's some development happening. Mm. But we also heard last night about the need statewide for, you know, perhaps 4,000, you know, new units in the short term that they're hoping to target with this nearly $350 million. We already heard that's unlikely to happen. We'll probably fall short of that target. And perhaps as many as, you know, 10,000 units being needed statewide, which, if you look at Bennington and that 1,000 number just in Bennington alone, you know, maybe an underestimate.
Well, as someone who spent 10th grade at the old Bennington High School building there, I find myself fascinated by the thought of being converted into a housing project, which would be a great thing. I keep on wondering, who's going to wind up in my old math class for their living room. Just real quick before we need to run here, I did want to get your thoughts on another subject that came up last night, but has also been an ongoing subject of a conversation. That's revisions to Act 250, because I'm sure you folks and what you do both in the energy and housing areas and everything else that you do run into that a lot. The legislature has been trying for the past couple of years to come up with revisions to Act 250. It's now, what, 50, more than 50-year-old statute. Again, a piece of legislation that came in response to development pressures from the 60s and early 70s. Probably a lot of people would agree it's done a lot of good, but it seems like it's also one of these things that get pointed to a lot is this is why we can't do this stuff because it gets appealed to Act 250 and on and instead of a one-year-long project, I've got a five-year-long project and I'm paying attorneys all the time. So any thoughts that Act 250 has now finally reached a point where the legislature must come up with a revised version, or live with the current version?
I'll say just in short, you could probably live with what we've got, but it definitely could be improved. Like you say, anything that's been around that long, like me, could definitely be, you could throw out parts of it and move on. But, you know, Act 250 gets blamed for almost everything. It's you know, the scapegoat for all sorts of permitting problems in the state. Act 250 is, in a lot of ways, kind of an umbrella permit that, you know, you have to get all these other state permits before you can get your Act 250 permit. And it's a lot of those underlying environmental permits that cause a lot of the problems and the delays themselves and ultimately with Act 250. So sure, Act 250, the process, the ability to bog problems, projects down through appeals and stuff, I really think that needs to get addressed. But you're not going to do it just by looking at high-level Act 250 criteria. You really have to get down into the state agency permitting level at some of those underlying permits where there are, I think, issues that are just as profound or more so than Act 250.
Yeah, I had that exact discussion following the forum last night with Representative Bongartz, who obviously is, you know, has intense interest and well-positioned to make suggestions on that. And from my perspective, as Jim said, Act 250 gets pointed to, everybody understands what it is. But we also heard about and know that developers want predictability. So I think it would be a significant improvement if we could get some level of predictability on those underlying permits. If there were statutory deadlines where the agencies had to respond to wastewater permits and stormwater permits and those other types of permits that Jim has mentioned, which are kind of the underlying agency level permits, I mean, they get dragged on, you know, sometimes for months at a time with no response. So I think it would be a significant improvement to simply have some, you know, hard deadlines on responses to those permits would certainly be helpful.
Mm. Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it there for today. I'm sure there's another half an hour we could discuss a lot of these issues on in even more depth, but I wanted to thank Jim Sullivan, the outgoing executive director of the Bennington County Regional Commission, and Bill Colvin, who's going to be coming in to replace him and filling those big shoes that I'm sure are going to be left behind. Fortunately, Mr. Sullivan's going to be hanging around for a little while longer, though, in an advisory capacity. Is that correct?
That's right. I like that. You're giving advice, but not doing anything, really. Yeah.
He reminds us daily as he comes into the office. Advisory only.
So. Don't blame me.
It's been great.
Well, gentlemen, thank you again for making the time for this. Really appreciate that. And thanks to all of you who've been with us today as well. Hope you found our program interesting. And we'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.